It's the morning show. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Kate Archer Kent, and we need to talk about noise. Now, the noise of a gas-powered leaf blower, we can agree that's just some noise pollution. But what about the sounds emanating from electric vehicles? There's one in my neighborhood that sounds a little bit something like a heavenly choir. That's the one. These EVs are all quieter than old-fashioned combustible engines, and that quiet can be disconcerting, if not downright dangerous. Have you considered these new sounds that our electric cars make, and what are some of their consequences as you hear it? 1-800-642-1234 to join our conversation this morning. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas at WPR.org. Deborah Kent Stein is a journalist and an activist with the National Federation of the Blind. And Deb, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Let's begin with your first experience with the Toyota Prius almost 20 years ago now, because it's become something of lore. I think it was, you know, largely part of the, it seems like part of the story about the 2010 law about the noises our electric cars make. What was your first experience like with a Toyota Prius?
Well, we have a family friend who is really into automobiles for a number of reasons, and one day he came by the house and he was driving a Toyota Prius, and he said, you know, this thing is so quiet, you really can't hear it at all. And I, as a blind person, I am very attuned to the sounds of cars because that's how I know when it's safe to cross the street. So I said, well, I want to hear it. I was convinced I would be able to hear it. And so we went out outside of my house in a quiet Chicago street. Yes, there is such a thing as a quiet Chicago street. And he got into his car and I heard the door close, and I stood on my sidewalk and I waited and I listened. And after a while, the door opened and he got out of the car, and I said, so when are you going to start up? And he said, well, actually, I drove up to the end of the block and then I backed up past you. And then I drove up to the end of the block again and backed up. And I felt this kind of chill to the bone because I had not heard a thing. And I thought, oh, we've got a problem.
Yeah, and Debbie, you were championing the passage of the 2010 Pedestrian Safety Enhancement Act. What does this law require?
Well, the law requires hybrid and electric motor vehicles to emit a sound which will indicate their presence to pedestrians. And they're supposed to make a sound when they are moving at a speed under 20 miles an hour, because when they're going faster, we would assume that you can hear the tires on the street, you can hear the wind rush. There's some sound that would be audible to pedestrians when they're going faster, but it's at the slow speeds when they're backing out of a driveway or coming out of an alley. That's when they really turned out to be dangerous.
And where do you see the 2010 Pedestrian Safety Enhancement Act was a decade ago? What have we learned since the passage of this law, Debbie?
Well, it took quite some time for the regulations of the law to actually go into effect. So it's not as though overnight after 2010, everything changed. And another thing is that the law does not require vehicles to be retrofitted. So there are still probably some of the older vehicles out there that are still very quiet. Overall, I think the law has made an improvement. And just as you indicated with that electric car, there are sounds that are being built into the new hybrid and electric vehicles. But the law has some things that are not covered that we're very concerned about. For instance, electric buses. The law does not cover vehicles that weigh more than 10,000 pounds. So back in 2010, we weren't too worried about that. We figured 10,000 pounds, that's pretty big. That should cover just about everything, but does not cover electric buses, does not cover electric 18-wheelers if they come along. And it also, on the other end of the spectrum, it doesn't cover the scooters, which are beginning to proliferate in cities. And they're small. They do go up to 15 miles an hour. And it's quite possible that you could not hear one and could be hit by it.
We're talking about what the cars of the future could or should sound like and why it's important that they make at least some noise. With us is Debbie Kent Stein, activist with the National Federation of the Blind. And if you could just, if you would, Debbie, take us through walking around outside. What sounds are you listening for? What are you paying attention to?
Well, I'm paying attention to a lot of things. I'm paying attention to the people in my environment, because I don't want to bump into people on the sidewalk. I like to give them as much space as they need. I'm listening to automobiles. When I get up to a corner, of course, I'm going to stop and kind of mentally map out the landscape of which cars are going parallel to me, because that would indicate that I can cross. I want to hear if cars are turning. I want to hear if somebody is idling at the intersection and maybe they're waiting to start up, and I want to give them their right of way. I don't want to second guess them and assume that they see me and they're going to give me space.
All of this seems to require some form of communication, Debbie, some form of expression, some noise, a sound.
Exactly.
Yeah. So have you had close calls with quiet electric vehicles outside of that first experience with a Prius almost 20 years ago?
I've had a couple of heart-stopping moments of walking around in downtown Chicago and suddenly hearing a car moving in front of me that's coming out of an alley that I wasn't aware that it was in the alley. So, you know, fortunately, it was making enough sound when it moved in front of me that I was able to stand still and let it pass. But one of the things we discovered in working on the quiet car legislation was how much sighted pedestrians and cyclists also depend on sound. So the activism that we got involved with also affected sighted pedestrians and cyclists all over the country.
I was certainly thinking of it this morning as there was a sign for a crosswalk, but I didn't need and wasn't looking at the sign. I just heard the ding of from the box, and that was enough for me to know that it was clear to go. So I know exactly what you're talking about. Debbie Kent Stein is our guest, author, journalist, activist with the National Federation of the Blind, asking you to think about what you hear out there. And we're talking about what the cars of the future could sound like and why it's important that they make some noise. And if you've had this experience like Debbie has, you are welcome to join our conversation. If you've thought of this world from our oral aspects, the sounds that our world makes and how they in some way are intended to keep us safe, join us. If you have stories like Debbie's that are a little heart-stopping, please share. They could make a difference this morning at 1-800-642-1234 or email ideas at WPR.org. I'm Lee Rayburn, and you're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. The Morning Show. I'm Lee Rayburn, and the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration estimates that in 2020, more than 6,500 pedestrians were killed in the United States, and another 55,000 were injured. 938 bicyclists were killed in traffic accidents. So far this year in Wisconsin, 56 pedestrians and 8 bicyclists have been killed by cars. How much do people rely on sound to stay safe? even if they don't realize it? That's where we're looking, listening this morning, and inviting you to join our conversation at 1-800-642-1234. What do you hear out there? Email available, ideas@WPR.org. Our guest, Debbie Kent Stein, is an activist with the National Federation of the Blind, a children's author and journalist, and she stays with us. And Deb, let me ask you, how much do people, how much do I rely on sound to stay safe without me even thinking about it?
Well, when we started working on legislation about hybrid and electric vehicles, eventually we were able to connect with people at the National Highway Transit Safety Administration, which is part of the Department of Transportation. And they did a study looking at statistics on injuries and deaths related to hybrid and electric cars. And the way they did this was they found the states that indicated the make of the vehicle that was involved in an accident with a pedestrian. And there were 12 states that gave that information, only 12, we were surprised. And so they were able to look at those 12 states and see how many of those accidents and even fatalities involved hybrid and electric vehicles. And it was rather shocking. It was a 50% greater likelihood that a pedestrian would be injured or even killed by a hybrid rather than an electric, rather than a traditional combustion vehicle. So that was really incontrovertible evidence that these cars were not only dangerous to blind people, but that they posed a hazard to sighted pedestrians and cyclists as well.
Which brings us to the phones, where Ilani in Fort Atkinson is standing by. Ilani, you're on the air with Deborah Kent Stein.
Good morning. I never gave it a thought in terms of someone being blind. But what I run into, I have a Prius, and what I run into in the area I live in, Fort Atkinson, we have a lot of walkers, and they have a tendency to walk in the street, and they walk on the wrong side of the street. And it makes me very nervous because I come up behind them, and it's like, you know, you don't have eyes in the back of your head, and you're not going to hear me. So that makes me nervous. The other thing, Whitewater, the city of Whitewater, has just passed a city ordinance. They can't, that golf carts will now be allowed on the streets, on any street that's posted for less than 25 miles an hour or less. So
those golf carts, the electric golf carts, can be completely silent, can't they?
Right. I would think so. But, well, you know, Whitewater has a very large community available for retirees. So that's why they've allowed the golf carts.
Ilani, as a Prius owner, I'm curious if you would like to have your car be a little louder. If they could turn up the artificial noise that your car makes as it comes down the street, would you turn it up?
Oh, well, yes. And see, mine doesn't have it because mine's an 07.
Okay.
And that's why I'm there's more than once that I have stopped people and told them, hey, you know, you need to be on the other side of the street when you're walking.
But they might have told you, Ilani, that your car's too quiet. I imagine this is not an uncommon problem, Debbie. And as you've worked on the legislation from 2010 and you've seen its passage and seen what updates it needs, how common are stories like these that you hear?
They're pretty common. And, you know, we are concerned. We've tried very hard to add pieces into the legislation about retrofitting. Another thing we've been concerned about, and we were not able to get it into the legislation, was for vehicles to make a sound at idle when, you know, when they're standing at the street crossing and waiting for the light to change so that they can move forward, the motor shuts off completely on many vehicles. And that's wonderful for greenhouse gases and all that, saving fuel, but means that it's sitting there and we've got no way to know that it's there. So when it starts up, it's a bit of a surprise.
Deborah Kent Stein, our guest, author, journalist, and activist with the National Federation of the Blind. As we listen for the automobiles that are coming down the street, what do you hear from the new electric vehicles at 1-800-642-1234? And have you thought about this before? And when you do, what do you think? Let's go to Mark in Wauwatosa now. Mark, you're on the air with Debbie Kent Stein.
Hello. I drive an electric vehicle for city tours in Milwaukee. It's like a six-passenger golf cart, just big enough. And we have a maximum speed on those vehicles of, we call them cruisers, of 25 miles per hour. And one trick that we use a lot is, when we're starting up at intersections, we just give a little tap on the horn, tap, and then to alert people.
Sure.
Because we can come up on people very quietly, and sometimes they're totally unaware that we're there.
Yeah, I appreciate that, Mark. And the tap on the horn is something that I would do around a blind corner in my automobile as well. But should the tap be necessary, or should this be part of a safety feature that comes standard in anything that's going to be out in the street?
Well, perhaps it should be standard. I don't know.
Something to think about, and I appreciate your perspective driving down and coming up on people like that. It makes me think of the airport when you have a people mover behind you in the airport and you realize it at the last second. Debbie, what are you working on right now? What's next for you? Is there an update that needs to happen for this 2010 legislation, and is there some impetus to get it done as you see it?
Well, we certainly would like to take on these hybrid and electric buses, which are moving around on downtown streets and in a lot of cities now. And I think they're going to be the wave of the future. It might be possible to get something added to the Pedestrian Safety Enhancement Act, or we may need some additional local or nationwide legislation. It's a daunting task, especially in today's political climate, to get things done.
Is it more, and from your experience, and this is, when you're talking about people who have disabilities, who are living with disabilities, are you more likely to get action furthered if you make the case that it's actually not just people with disabilities, but all of us, that if it were just isolated to disabilities, there is some concern that people with disabilities, there is some concern that there might not be the wherewithal to get something accomplished?
Yes, I think it definitely gives added impetus, because really this is an issue that affects everybody.
Thank you for that. And let's go. We've got time for another caller here. Kyle's in Minneapolis, and he joins us. Kyle, you're on the air with Debbie Kent Stein.
Oh, hi, guys. Minneapolis I'm from. I just work here in Milwaukee, and I listen to NPR in Minneapolis usually, but the radio waves don't reach that far.
Right.
But I was just jumping in on this conversation. I, a current owner of a Model 3 Tesla, had two Chevy Volts with a V. I've had a Chevy Bolt with a B. And I also, if you cruise around downtown, you will see me on a Harley Livewire, which is electric.
Oh, wow. What's Harley Livewire sound like, Kyle?
Yeah, everywhere I bring this thing, people just gawk at it and go, what is that? But yes, they made a electric motorcycle 2 years ago. It wasn't a hot seller, but even that vehicle, you guys were discussing the federal laws. That one does not have a noisemaker. Obviously, as a motorcyclist, I do not want to hit a pedestrian, because that would hurt both of us. And Mike, I was trying to get at, the Volt, the older Volt, had a pedestrian warning button on it that you hit that was a little different than the horn. And I don't know why they quit doing that with all of them, because you can see I transitioned and they just don't have that little dee 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 dee. It's a different noise than.
So you've had all these electric vehicles. Which one do you feel safest in when you're out on the road?
The Livewire.
Really? On the motorcycle? Why?
Well, you can dodge people.
Okay.
And the Livewire does have a loud chain case or a gearbox,
all
so
right.
There is probably no noisemaker because of that. You can kind of hear a clanking coming down the road. But yeah, the Tesla also will stop by itself if a pedestrian gets in front of it.
Kyle, it's good to get the perspective of somebody who's been behind the wheel of so many of these electric vehicles. And Debbie Kenstein, I apologize because we're just out of time, but it, I hope, has brought this issue to the fore and at least made people listen for it when they're out and about today. And thank you for bringing it to our attention this morning.
Thank you for having me.
Debbie Kenstein is a children's book author, a journalist, and an activist with the National Federation of the Blind. I'm Lee Rayburn, and you're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. Last year, there were 643 overdose deaths in Milwaukee County. That's more than the homicides and the suicides and the car accident deaths combined. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Kate Archer Kent. And it's not just Milwaukee County. We don't have statewide numbers yet for last year, but in 2020, the Wisconsin Department of Health counted 1,227 opioid deaths. Maybe you know or knew someone dealing with this addiction, whether you knew it or not. So what needs to be done here? What can be done here? And where can those we know go to get better? Join the conversation, 1-800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Our guest is Jay Ford, an assistant professor at the School of Pharmacy at UW-Madison. His research focuses on expanding the use and adoption of practices to improve patient outcomes and quality of care. Hey, Jay, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Good morning. Thank you for having me this morning.
Let's begin with the role that methadone and other drugs like it can play in treating opioid addiction. What makes methadone effective, as you see, Jay, in treating opioid addictions?
Well, one of the things about methadone is it's kind of a long-acting opioid agonist. So it's something that's going to help the individual with an opioid use disorder, you know, reduce their craving. And it's going to help, with withdrawal and kind of blunt and block the effects of the opioid that they're taking. Methadone as a medication is something that individuals have to take on a daily basis. So they have to go and either take the medication in a liquid or a tablet or a kind of a powder or diskette form. But it's something they have to do, in person. And somebody actually has to see them take the medication.
So it sounds like there's a process to use methadone and to start the process of recovery. So give me some idea in the eyes of somebody with an addiction, what steps they take to get to being able to use methadone in a recovery program.
Yeah, so that's a good question. So first of all, methadone, like many of the other medications, was approved by the Federal Food and Drug Administration. But what's unique about methadone compared to something like buprenorphine or naltrexone is it can only be dispensed at opioid treatment programs that are licensed by the Substance Use and Mental Health Services Administration at the federal government. So in Wisconsin, there are about 20 to 25 of these organizations. Most of them are in the Madison, Milwaukee, or kind of up toward the Fox Valley area. But someone who is taking methadone would have to typically, get up probably fairly early in the morning, drive to the closest opioid treatment program in the state. They would wait in line until the program actually opened, and then they would go in and typically they'll have a urine drug screen or a urine drug test to make sure that they're not on opioids. If that comes back, negative, then they'll be given the methadone dose either as a liquid or, as I mentioned, a powder or a diskette form. And then they'll take that in front of an individual within the opioid treatment program. So the idea, what they're trying to avoid by doing that is someone diverting methadone, to somebody else. So then the person leaves, but then they have to come back and do that the next day. So this is an ongoing daily basis that people have to go through to get their methadone. You know, works great, maybe if you're in a city like Madison or Milwaukee, where it's a little easier to get to.
It sounds like barrier after barrier for people. Yes. Who we would be trying to eliminate these barriers towards recovery. And we wonder why we have an opioid epidemic and why it's difficult to get our hands around it. And there are many aspects to this, but one would be getting people into a system for recovery. And one of the easy, or at least most available systems for recovery would be at least starting a replacement therapy to get away from street drugs, which we, as we know, have become increasingly deadly with fentanyl supply. So, Jay Ford, from your position here, why are there more barriers for using methadone versus some of the other drugs you've mentioned? And I've heard from others saying they prefer the other drugs, but maybe that's just because of the process here.
Yeah. So, each one of the kind of the three main medications for opioids have their own barriers. We talked a little bit about methadone. Someone who's on buprenorphine, which is another medication, they can only get that from a physician that has gone through specialized training. Whereas a medication like naltrexone is something that a provider, a nurse practitioner, could prescribe to an individual, and they could get that without the barriers. I think some of these barriers, exist from a system that was, created long ago. One of the issues might be that, about 40% of the OTPs are run by for-profit companies, which is fine, but, moving away from that model is going to hurt, their bottom line. But the idea that someone has to get up, 5:30 in the morning to go get a medication, for a chronic condition is crazy, because if we're a diabetic or an asthmatic or with high blood pressure, we don't have to go to a specialized clinic every day to watch somebody take our medication.
So what I'm getting from you, Jay Ford, is that we have some outdated rules that in some way may be impeding our opportunity to work towards getting a handle on an opioid epidemic that is becoming increasingly deadly on the streets.
Yes, I think that's true. I know that there's a push at the federal level to relax some of the, or to continue, not relax, continue some of the rules that were put in place during the COVID-19 pandemic. Especially as it relates to access to methadone and other medications. People are looking at ways to, continue to allow, take-home methadone that was occurring during the pandemic and other things. So the SAMHSA and the federal government are looking at ways to maybe waive and put some of those rules into place permanently.
And you would be, from your position and your work, you would see that as an effective and you would be supportive of this relaxing of these restrictions for the purpose of dealing with this opioid epidemic and, people who are struggling with addiction?
Yeah, I think the more we can do to increase access to medications for opioid use disorders that people need, the better. I mean, there are just too many barriers that exist in the systems to allow people to easily access the medications. And so there are opportunities to improve that. And I think the more that we embrace and try these new ideas, the better off we are in terms of trying to address the ongoing opioid epidemic.
So we're talking about how drugs for opioid use disorder are distributed with Jay Ford. He's an assistant professor at the UW-Madison School of Pharmacy, and we invite you to join us. Have you undergone treatment for opioid use disorder? And what barriers to access have you faced when trying to get drug treatment? Share your stories. They may help. 1-800-642-1234. Or you can email us ideas at WPR.org. Jay, one of the things that I've heard, but I haven't heard you mention yet, is Suboxone, another a replacement therapy drug that would be available that I've heard some prefer to methadone. And I'm wondering, again, is that because of the drug itself or the barriers involved?
Suboxone is, a different type of medication. And so typically that is something that has to be dispensed as part of kind of the larger buprenorphine family that, but it has to be dispensed by a physician or a nurse practitioner who's undergone specialized training. And those individuals typically can only see a certain number of patients on their panel. So while it's better and somebody can go get that and maybe get a 7-day supply of Suboxone that they can take at home without that direct supervision, there's still barriers in place to getting access to that. So I think in terms of Suboxone versus methadone, it really is, comes down to kind of the medication that's going to work best for the individual. Some people are more tolerant of something like Suboxone than they are methadone. But others prefer methadone because it provides them with an accountability that they feel like they need on a daily basis in terms of taking the medications.
And you alluded to this, Jay Ford, and I want to ask you directly about the pandemic. And I mentioned how, we're just beginning to understand because of the isolation that comes with addiction and the isolation that came with pandemic. It wasn't abundantly clear or immediately clear. And we've seen the same thing with alcohol addiction recently. I would ask you how you see the pandemic affecting not just the opioid epidemic, but how the distribution of methadone and other replacement therapies available to begin recovery.
Yeah, I think one of the things that, that impacted it most likely was just, people's general access. I mean, I think the treatment programs did their best to, stay open and provide services, but, they had to get a little creative because some of these services, might also come with having a counseling session with a licensed behavioral health specialist, a social worker, to talk through some of the addiction issues. Well, the ability to meet in person, went away. So then you had to kind of start thinking creatively about the use of telehealth or other mechanisms to provide this connection for people. So I think you had that going on, but you also had individuals, isolation. So there wasn't, maybe there wasn't accountability for someone who was struggling with an opioid or an alcohol use disorder of someone who could actually, help them, get the help that they needed.
Jay Ford, our guest, assistant professor at the School of Pharmacy at UW-Madison, taking your questions at 1-800-642-1234, taking a look at access to methadone and other drugs that can be effective in beginning the process of recovery for people who are struggling with addiction. What questions do you have about what we can do to reduce the barriers and begin the process towards recovery for those who are seeking it? 1-800-642-1234 to join us. I'm Lee Rayburn, and you're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. Democratic Senator Ed Markey and Republican Senator Rand Paul introduced legislation that would ease the rules around the distribution of methadone, a replacement narcotic used to treat opioid addiction. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm Lee Rayburn, and our guest is Jay Ford, assistant professor at the UW School of Pharmacy. Have you or someone you know had any experience in dealing with methadone clinics? And if you're in recovery, please share your story with us. It may just help provide a roadmap for others. 1-800-642-1234 to join the conversation, or you can email us, ideas@wpr.org. And Jay, Wisconsin is set to receive over $400 million as part of three separate settlements now. The Wisconsin Department of Health Services says expanded treatment options are a priority. If you were in charge of this purse, how would you see that money spent?
Wow, that's a good question. One of the things I would look at is, really working with and across the healthcare community, in particular, there are pharmacies in almost every community, and pharmacists are trained to, dispense medication. And I think that's one of the things that's in the act that you mentioned that coming back into this segment is the Bipartisan Opioid Treatment Act is encouraging to allow pharmacists to dispense, you know, methadone to people from the opioid treatment program. You know, so that's one thing I think we can look at, you know, maybe trying to figure out how can we expand, you know, access to other medications like buprenorphine or Vivitrol. There's some of these medications that are long acting injections. So I think, you know, providing access through either pharmacies or other healthcare providers is a way to do that. You know, one of the other things that could be creative is actually take the medications to the individual. So this idea of, you know, creating maybe a mobile medication van, you know, for people who don't have access and actually go to these individuals and bring, you know, bring the access to them rather than having somebody have to drive, you know, hours to get to an OTP if they're taking methadone. You know, maybe you take the mobile van to them and they only have to drive to somewhere in their local community to get that. So, you know, I think those are just some ideas off the top of my head about how we might use that money.
Sure. And Jay, I want to ask, do we have enough access to detox services for people who are dealing with opioid addiction or opioid use disorder?
In my opinion, no. You know, there are a lot of wonderful, you know, treatment programs, you know, across the state, but a lot of them are limited by capacity, whether it be bed capacity, whether it be capacity of trained staff like physicians who need to be able to prescribe methadone or buprenorphine, and then even, you know, trained staff to work with these individuals. You know, there's a lot of great people that are working in the field, and I've met a lot of them both in Wisconsin and across the country, but I don't think they have all the support that they need, you know, to do that. And so I think there's more that we could do to look for opportunities to expand these services, you know, in all corners of the state.
Let's go to your calls and questions now at 1-800-642-1234, where Lori in Madison is standing by. Lori, you're on the air with Jay Ford, assistant professor at the UW School of Pharmacy.
Hi, yeah, thank you. I'm just calling to talk about my concern. One of the huge barriers I see is just the immediacy to treatment. I feel that when an addict decides that they want treatment, you know, having to wait for an appointment is a barrier. I mean, when the person is ready for treatment, it's like you have such a sweet spot to get them into treatment. And when they have to wait, you kind of lose that opportunity. So a real huge barrier is just that lack of immediate access to treatment.
Lori, I appreciate your call. Thank you. And that window, Jay Ford, and as you work on your research focuses on expanding the use and adoption of practices to improve patient outcomes and the quality of care, what do you think about that window and how we have to get people into that window, as small as it may be?
Yeah, Lori is really right on in terms of what she's talking about. When I first got into the field, oftentimes people would have to wait, you know, weeks or longer, you know, just to get an initial appointment for somebody to come in and screen them, you know, to determine whether or not they are, you know, even eligible to get services. You know, some providers have moved to a walk-in, you know, clinic model, which I think helps reduce some of those barriers, but they still exist. I mean, especially if someone needs, you know, residential inpatient treatment, that's a strong issue of access to beds. I think it's more prevalent, most likely in the state, in terms of adolescent treatment beds. So, you know, going back to your earlier question, you know, that might be another opportunity is to try to look at, you know, residential treatment programs in the state and expand where necessary, whether that be for adolescents or adults.
Lori, thank you so much for the call. Still time for yours at 1-800-642-1234. And Sean from Green Bay had a note here about people he knew who were taking methadone, but also still using intoxicants. Whether or not that is, you know, something that you've seen, Jay, that methadone is being used, but there is still a lack of a recovery process there.
I haven't seen that personally, but I'm not surprised that, you know, some of that's going on. I mean, you know, the methadone is designed to block the cravings for opioids, but, you know, someone could still be, you know, taking other medications or dealing with other, you know, co-occurring issues. You know, maybe their opioid is being blunted, but they're still, you know, drinking and have an alcohol issue. So yeah. I'm not surprised that of that going on.
Let's go to Pete in Green Bay. Pete, you're on the air with Jay Ford from the UW School of Pharmacy.
How you doing, Jay?
I'm fine, Pete.
Hey, I was talking about the money that the state's getting. Unfortunately, I've got a son that I deal with addiction. It's been going on for probably 5 years. He's 24 years old, or 25. So probably a little bit more than that, actually, as far as the length of time. But I've taken him in where he's wanted to go in and tried to get him to detox at a couple different places, went through the emergency rooms at a couple different places. And the emergency rooms will not, the hospital systems won't take a opioid addiction for detox. Their thoughts are that, you know, they'll get them in there for 72 hours and then, you know, they leave the hospital back to using again, which may be valid, may not be valid, but, there seems to be a lot of roadblocks in trying to get into a actual detox area where he really, you know, had made the choice to, I'm going to do this, you know, and we get to the hospital and then only to be turned away. You know, and I've done that a couple times with him. So maybe, you know, some more treatment on that end of it. I'm not sure how it would work. But the other thing is he's in a methadone program right now that works well for him. The barriers that he had originally a couple years ago about getting into the methadone program don't seem to be there anymore, like costs and paying up front. But so at least he's in a harm reduction phase. I'm not saying that he doesn't still use because he does, you know, they use marijuana in that. So he's got other things going on along with that. But he does not miss going to the methadone clinic. So at least for now, that's a plus. So that's a lot there, and I'll hang up and listen to your answer.
Pete, I very much appreciate you sharing your family story. And, Jay, we're just about out of time here. So what can you say to Pete's experience?
First of all, Pete, thank you for sharing that. I know it's got to be very challenging. And, unfortunately, I think it's relatively common. I think there are, you know, inherent challenges in the system that really do need to be addressed. I mean, we don't face these challenges if we're trying to get help for other chronic conditions.
Yeah, and something to keep in mind. Jay Ford, thank you so much for joining us this morning.
You're welcome. Thank you very much.
Assistant professor at the School of Pharmacy at UW-Madison. Just ahead, we're talking about hospice care and Medicaid, and what questions do you have about end-of-life compassionate care? That's after the news. I'm Lee Rayburn, and you're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network.